Welcome back, everyone. We have
Thank
Katie
you.
with us again.
Hey!
There was much
I've
rejoicing.
From my Fortress of Solitude or wherever I have been.
For those who don't know, Katie's pregnant.
Yes.
So, tell us.
And is it true that you've decided to name your baby Harge, no matter what the is?
I have many people, like multiple people, campaigning for Channing Tatum Baltus as the baby's name, which you know, there are worse names.
It's a good name.
Yeah,
I don't know
but
about
Carol. Carol is a backup. Whether it's a boy, but you know, Carol works.
Yeah.
Oh, it is a boy.
Yes, but you know, like Matt Damon on 30 Rock, he was named Carol.
That's true. You did okay.
The film criticism doesn't need more boys. This is
I know. Faster. I know another white man in the world. I'm really doing my part.
Well, so tell us this: what is more true about pregnancy, Juno, Rosemary's Baby, or 9 months?
I mean, there's definitely definitely moments where I feel like Juno, and I just have wound up doing this thing that I have no business doing and don't feel responsible for at all. And I worry about the whole hospital process, bringing back flashes of Rosemary's Baby, of just being surrounded by people who are telling you what to do and won't explain anything to you. So we'll see. But so far, no one seems to be scheming against me or selling my child to the devil.
That you know of.
Yeah. I don't know what you guys...
given yourself that horrible, we need to talk about Kevin haircut.
No, oh God. Yeah, and okay. We need to talk about Kevin is definitely on the list of movies I should not watch for quite a long time.
Yeah, maybe never again. Yeah. Maybe just put that in a box and, put it away.
So Nick is also here. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
And Joe.
Hi.
And me, Nathaniel.
Yay.
Yay.
So we have all been seeing different things.
Is that just summer movie season where some of us give in and see the huge movies and some of us just refuse?
I think
who
there's
some of us, Katie.
Some of us might be smarter than to see X-Men. Let's see.
I think also in the summertime there's that sense of, oh, I can catch this on DVD or VOD at the end of the year and I'll be fine. There's not that sense at the end of the year where it's just like, I gotta see everything before it's too late.
Yeah.
Or is that just me?
No, definitely. Yeah. It's because I've actually thought that about Money Monster, for example. I'm oh, that'll be on DVD before the end of the year if I must see it.
Definitely in the category of movies that if you didn't see before it opened, the essentialness just disappears. All of a sudden it's true. I'll get to it.
Yeah, because I actually thought of it as one of those movies where it'll be something nobody talks about in 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
So is that...
It'd be a very hard trivia question of, the movie that George Clooney and Julia Roberts made together that isn't an Oceans movie.
Although I still feel like we'll still talk about the movies that Jodie Foster directed just because there are so few of them and because she was such a big star or is such a big star. Even if it's in the context of...
Little Man Tate.
In the context of, why her movies were never a bigger deal or were never better. I didn't really dislike Money Monster, but it doesn't deliver on its potential. It's not terrible, but I can't exactly go around telling people you gotta see Money Monster because it's just not that movie.
Yeah. I actually liked it a good amount and basically felt the same way. I was very entertained by this. I really like Jack O'Connell. I'm rooting for him in this very
I did
way.
Too. And I remember watching that trailer and being oh, this poor kid with the voice and the accent or whatever. And I think
the accent is a nightmare. It's bad.
But he still manages to deliver a really strong character despite that accent, which I know the accent is something he's doing as well, but sometimes it seems like something that's happening to him. And I just wanted to give him credit for fighting through it.
So yeah. is his accent just a simple American accent or is he doing a regional?
No, he's
no,
very clean.
Doing a tough street, tough guy, you better not mess with me, kind of.
Yeah.
It's that.
Okay.
Wow, Joe.
We all sound like this.
Nick, did you feel the same way?
It was just like watching something. I felt the same way when I watch a lot of movies Jodie Foster's in, like The Brave One, where you start with a premise that should at least kind of have a good hook. And for a while it does, and then you just watch the movie make itself more preposterous until you're like, honey, where does your mind go? Or as I was slightly proud of tweeting, it just felt like her Golden Globe speech again. It's like, I see what you're saying, but what in the world are you saying?
Yeah, it definitely takes a turn. It takes a couple of turns, and I kind of like where it winds up, because you get this, like, you know, the public rallying around someone, kind of Dog Day Afternoon vibe about it, but it's a weird way to get there, and it doesn't, like, the twist and the direction of this media spectacle. It's like she doesn't, it's like she's mad at cable news, but doesn't totally get it about how cable news works, and I don't even watch that much of it, but a lot of it felt false to me.
Well, there's a really weird idea about whose redemption we might be interested in, or what, like, constitute, like, a happy ending, or at least a reassuring gesture. Like, that's not it. Not that. Yeah.
Also, that scene with the girlfriends is embarrassingly cartoonish.
It's the girlfriend really... who isn't Amber Tamblyn, but...
Right. Emily Mead, who I really like. She's been in some TV shows that I think she's been really good in. She was in Boardwalk Empire for a short while. She was in The Leftovers. I think she's a talented actress, but, like, they do hang her out to dry in this movie with a really thankless task in a really sort of unbelievable plot twist.
Who are you guys talking about?
Her name's Emily Mead.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen her in anything.
She's Jack O'Connell's girlfriend.
Yeah.
She's in the preview doing the only thing she really does in the movie, which is, like, call in to the crisis.
Yeah.
And I kind of loved it just because it was a release valve for, like, I mean, the whole audience I was with laughed.
Yeah. And
on the borderline of starting to laugh at this movie a little bit anyway by that point, and something fun to slurp up in a way.
Yeah.
See, I saw this with a, like, Upper West Side crowd who had been, like, recruited to see it, I guess, and they were so into it, which I think really impacted my feeling of this movie. I, you know, I kind of, like, went with it in a way, which I guess just really speaks to the power of an audience. And I was more inclined to kind of let it go along with me.
Well,
Joe, I want to hear you talk about the Julia Robertsness of this, because I feel like it's a really interesting role for her, and she's really interesting in it, and you're the Julia Roberts stan in my life.
I mean, it's very non-flashy. You could have cast somebody with a whole lot less star power and cachet than Julia Roberts, and you would have gotten away with it, because you don't need a ton of, like, star wattage to do what she does, and she's in this control room for the entire movie, when she's not in, like, a control van, you know what I mean? Like, she's, you know, sort of running things behind the scenes. Part of me feels like it's a waste of Julia Roberts, because it's like, this is not what you hire her to do. The movie plays on her chemistry with Clooney even when they're not in the same room, which I think is interesting, and it's to the movie's benefit. I think they have a very good sort of instant, it's that thing you can do with movie stars where, because the audience has a sort of institutional memory of them together, you don't have to do a whole lot of work to get the audience to the point where you know how connected these two are, which I think helps a lot. I don't know, did you find this to be a really interesting role for her?
I just liked the whole, like, I kind of liked her and Katrina Balfe, who plays the assistant Dominic
West.
I liked
her a lot.
And I like them as these, like, women in these assistant roles that have all the power, because it's, like, a really common trope where it's like, oh, well, nothing would ever happen if it wasn't for my producer, Mary, like, and even though it's the men taking all the glory, and how they kind of take over the narrative of the movie, and just kind of Julia Roberts in this role as, like, the calling the shots, like, you know, Holly Hunter in Broadcast News, but, I mean, the character itself is not that well-defined, like, bringing up Broadcast News is a bad idea in context of this movie, but I like her and Clooney, like you were saying about their chemistry, and I just like her, like, kind of, you know, wearing a sweater, like, doing a job.
Sure.
Not her, like, most Julia Roberts, but getting something out of it.
It was interesting that the movie doesn't really interrogate this idea that she's making a TV show out of this unfolding tragedy. Do you know what I mean? Like, I
treat it as a triumph. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
But, like, not even, like, a, like, capital T triumph. Just sort of, like, this low-key, just, like, just doing her job. And it's, like, the movie doesn't even take a second to reflect on how kind of fucked up that is.
Yeah, it's trying to kind of satirize the idea of, like, death being for cable ratings, but, you know, like, the network idea, but it really loses track of that.
Well,
I do think it kind of, the T does kind of go capital at the moment that, I mean, I said to Derek when I got home, like, I just can't imagine sitting in my word processor at this point in history and typing the sentence, it's her last day ever on the job.
Yeah.
Like, I'm an asshole, you know?
Yeah.
Like, to the extent that this whole experience convinces her to, like, stick with it, like, that right. did feel like it had been a pretty robust, like, we really did something here. Because I agree with everything you guys said about, and not to deny Joe's stan status in this conversation, but if you'd read the Julia Roberts interview in InStyle magazine, as I did yesterday, you would learn that she came up with this whole backstory about how both her father and her uncle were news producers, and they had been, like, ashamed of her going into this financial outfit, but she thought this show was going to be really good until it went really... So she did a whole, like, dive on who this character was, which I think you feel that commitment a little bit in the first half of the movie until it's just... like preposterously shouting at interns on the bridge while they walk down Wall Street.
I will say, listening to you guys talk about it makes me want to see it less, even though you all kind of liked it.
Always felt aggrieved and up in the air that they cut at the moment when George Clooney's about to dance to Bust a Move. Like, I thought we should see that, but this movie convinces me that we did not need to see that. Is fine. It's
Clooney dancing is. Yeah, you can't unsee it.
I don't know why they cut away.
Yeah,
Clooney does a fair amount of hip hop dancing in this movie. Yeah. Which might not have guessed.
So is this like Warren Beatty and Bulworth?
No,
Like a cable news guy who's like old and white and thinks he can do whatever he wants.
With some silly black backup dancers that, if they'd paid attention when they were leaving the set, none of this would have happened.
Oh, God. That's true. Shut your doors behind you, people.
Yeah,
keep secure.
Anyway.
So, Nick, what are you desperate to know about X-Men Apocalypse since you haven't seen it?
Ask us anything.
Well, I'll quote my friend Nancy Kerrigan and just ask, why? Why? Why did someone do violence to someone, I guess?
Who do you think is being violence done to the most?
The public?
I spent a lot of the time before I saw it wondering about which actor I would feel the most embarrassed for in the movie.
Well, have you guys?
There's so many to choose from.
Have you guys read the piece on The Ringer about the self-loathing index of X-Men?
Yeah, that was a good one.
It was so funny. So funny. It has all these different categories, and one is slightly too famous for the room, which is Rose Byrne. And then wants to die as Jennifer Lawrence because she's so bored.
Yeah. Yeah, she definitely wants out. It's the movie was kind of interesting because it's sort of a fighting between its impulses to, like, hand the franchise off to, like, the new class. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of just like, oh, these are the freshman orientation kind of kids, and we're gonna put them through their paces.
And they're new in this movie, or like the new ones that have been new since like First Class?
No, ones in this movie.
Who have been?
Oh my God! There's more.
Who have? Been,
who are playing?
Who are playing the people who were introduced in the first movie in 2000?
Yeah, exactly. But new versions of those characters.
Right.
Oh my God, you guys. Okay.
Yeah, the X-Men movies really, like, you know, the whole, like,
they're
it's
so
a trilogy.
Repetitive.
Like,
they're
yeah,
so
I mean,
repetitive.
The whole idea of a franchise being a trilogy is kind of over at this point. Like Iron Man 4. Who knows? But the X-Men movies have really made a hash out of that idea.
This movie strains under the weight of how many different kind of objectives it has. I still mostly liked it. There's too much happening to really feel satisfied by any one aspect of it, even though, like, small parts of it, lots of small parts of it work for me. I think Sophie Turner is really good as Jean Grey. Fassbender does a really great job, especially in the film's early scenes, getting you to sort of an emotional place with his character. It doesn't pay off because I don't even remember, like, what he does at the end of the movie.
It doesn't.
He doesn't do it. He, like, floats in midair for, like, a third of the movie.
And,
right.
And also, we've seen him do that exact arc in the other movies, too.
Yes.
Sure.
Because he always commits these atrocities, and then somebody convinces him he's good. And I mean, it's just so repetitive. I did not like it at all.
So, I've seen First Class, and I can't remember if I watched Days of Future Past, but I think I didn't. But would you think it would be good for X-Men to kind of go the Marvel route and occasionally, like, try to have clusters of these characters that are not always the same cluster be in movies together, rather than, it seems even just from watching trailers, like, this franchise's mania for squeezing 800 people into every movie is too much.
Yes,
but
and none of them are serviced because of it. 'Cause, like,
right.
But Bryan Singer is not Robert Altman. Like, he can't juggle that much.
But does this movie do anything to bring out some relationships that other ones didn't, or
no?
Is it even trying? Is that not its goal?
Well, introducing Jean Grey it happened in the previous movies, but like she and Magneto kind of establish a relationship by the end. Actually, I agree that there's too many characters in the movie. Like we can talk about Olivia Munn and what in the world she wound up doing here. But I like that when you get the X-Men together, everyone has powers that complement each other, and they're learning through them, and they're not just like some mishmash of people who can do powerful things fighting in some big city. I want them to keep the ensemble thing going, even if that means we have to watch Professor X and Magneto have like the same conversation.
I vehemently disagree. Like, obviously, like it would be great if they kept an ensemble, but I think it's important to change up which characters are together, because otherwise it's just like rehash. And the strange thing about it is, I grew up very obsessed with the X-Men, and so I was like obsessed with them for years before they were ever put on television or the movies, and there are hundreds of characters, and they keep using like the same five in the same formations about the same relationships with the same arcs. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's weird.
There's a lot of like haphazard inclusion of characters and sort of like leaving characters behind. I don't understand why they had Jubilee go on that little like movie mall adventure with the other kids and then come back and just get left behind.
Just vanish. It's weird.
It's very strange, particularly because, I mean, and not to say that like characters should be included in plots just for diversity's sake, but like, you know, it might help to have, you know, a cool young Asian woman superhero. Like, that's awesome. Like, this Asian American girl. And it's just like, they sort of leave her behind. Like, what happens to Havoc is very, like, tossed off and just sort of like, well, that happened. And it's just like, okay. Though I was really liking him, because the characters that I liked were all the ones with the best hair, and he had.
Well, that's why you like Sophie Turner.
Yes, no, my feelings on this movie are ultimately very hair-based, and it's,
So how did McAvoy's, baldness, which is revealed in the trailers, how'd that hit you?
I mean, I'm glad that it was revealed in the trailer so that it wasn't a surprise, because it was a blow, and I'm not gonna lie, because his hair was the 80s-est, it was very, like, Don Johnson, it was awesome.
Yeah, but can we talk about how great his head is shaped?
Oh, yeah, he has a good shaped head.
He looks amazing bald.
Yeah, he does.
What accounts for X2 being so much better than all the other ones? Is that a controversial statement?
No, X2, no, everyone agrees, right? With that, yeah.
Okay, so it's, and I agree, I mean, I think I've seen like half of the movies at this point, and that one was so good. So if you had to pinpoint the difference between that one and the other ones, like what did that one do that other ones could do or try to do if they're going to keep making
it? Well, my first thing I would say is it's much more faithful to the comic books than the other ones.
Really? Okay.
Like, it understands the the sort of core of the characters better than the other movies do. It seems like it's trying to, like, adapt what the school is like and what, you know, the different relationships are like, whereas the other movies seem like they're about, oh, we have a big star in Jennifer Lawrence, so Mystique has to be the major character, even though she's not a major character at all in the comic books. And it touched on all these like things that are already classic tropes within the comics. Like, A, it's the most successful movie at using mutant dumb as like an allegory for you know, minorities.
Political stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, because they have the whole coming out sequence, and it's light enough that it doesn't feel heavy-handed like it has in some other movies.
It also feels like the classic part two, in that part one was that sort of semi-clunky origin story, although I do like X-Men part one. And then that pays off all those relationships that were set up, adds a couple of new ones, and is very kind of economical in the way it deals with its storylines. And then once you get to the third one, that's where things start to bloat.
That's what's so weird about this as a third installment. Like, there's no like big like, this is the end of we're wrapping up our trilogy. Like, it's right. So all over the place, which,
yeah,
again, is like how you know, like, hey, McAvoy, you want to come back? You're like, sure, we'll have you back. Like, they're like making no promises for the future, basically, which is a little frustrating. Can we talk about Oscar Isaac? I was very worried about Oscar Isaac in this movie, I think for obvious reasons, because being painted blue and covered in latex in a superhero movie has gone really wrong for a lot of people. And I don't think he's good in it, but I don't think he's bad. Like, it really kind of felt like he just got away with it and then got the hell out of there.
I just didn't get why they wanted an actor that magnetic when, you know.
Yes. This is the eternal question about, like Josh Brolin as Thanos and Lee Pace is in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. If you can't recognize them, what's the point? Just hire a character actor.
This is why we have the Doug Joneses of the world to play these sort of latexed up creatures. And so we're not putting, like, our finest actors through these paces for no reason.
Yeah, you watch the scenes of, like, Oscar Isaac confronting Michael Fassbender, and you're like, wait, we got these two actors on screen together, and that's what we got out of it?
Yeah.
Such a waste.
Yeah.
The younger actors who they brought together for this sort of, you know, freshman class, I thought were all really good.
I just have to go back to the Jubilee thing for a second, and I guess we should move on. But the other reason I'm getting progressively more and more angry and dissatisfied with this franchise is that it seems impossible to me that they've futzed it up so much in terms of diversity, because the comics are actually, it was kind of the first comic book to be totally diverse.
Yeah.
And Storm is the size of a character as the movies have given Mystique. So they've given a blonde white lady the size of the role that Storm has always had in the comic books. And it's just like, why? I mean, because Storm is like a fan favorite. Like, she's almost everybody's favorite other than Wolverine.
And yeah, as somebody who never watched the cartoon or read the comics, I knew two X-Men going into the first movie, and they were Wolverine and Storm.
Anyway.
Are they still doing a Gambit movie? Is that still happening?
I think so. I think it got delayed.
And Deadpool is an X-Men movie?
Well,
sort
technically,
of.
Ryan Reynolds was in the really bad Wolverine origin movie as Deadpool.
He was supposed
to spin off sort of directly from that, and because
but thank God
everything
it didn't,
involved in that was such a clusterfuck.
Yeah,
I haven't seen Deadpool, but I don't think it has anything to do with anything in the X-Men universe as we know it, right?
I don't think so.
The Wikipedia page rolls hard on it being one of the 9 X-Men
movies.
That's interesting.
No, okay. It totally is part of the X-Men lore. So the deal is that Fox owns the X-Men. So, like, any character that is primarily associated with the X-Men, they get. Here's where you get the whole thing of, like, and I hate to, like, praise Marvel because I'm, like, kind of tired of all these superhero movies.
Just praise Marvel, Nathaniel.
But,
they deserve it.
No, but the thing is, this is why their movies are so much better than other people's movies. The very fact that that in X-Men Origins Wolverine, that they introduce Deadpool with Ryan Reynolds, and he has his mouth sewn shut. Reason anybody loves the character of Deadpool is that he can't is that he can't fucking shut up, and he's constantly quipping. So, like, you realize that one of the reasons Marvel Studios has been so successful is that they are part of the comic book company and they understand the characters.
Yeah.
And where these other studios, they get the rights to something and they just don't care, and they hire people who, they're like, oh, we can make money at superpowers, you know, and they don't really think about all of the core mythology and stuff.
There is something to be said for having an overarching corporate vision. Like, it keeps the trains running on time.
So let's move on from superheroes.
Hey, Love and Friendship is all about superheroes. Every time Chloe Sevigny comes on screen in that movie, it's just like 2.5 minutes of perfection, and then she just, like, walks off again. And it's just like, see you soon, Chloe, because I know it's going to be great. Because she'll just, like, fire off this, like, backhanded comment about someone. God, I could listen to her and Kate Beckinsale do Whit Stillman dialogue all day. All day and all night.
Love that they made that character from Connecticut, which she's not in the novella.
Right?
Oh, nice.
Chloe Sevigny is from there, and, like, her horror seems so genuine about having to be banished back to Darien. Like,
yeah.
What is that place that they always threaten on Golden Girls that Dorothy's always threatening her mother with?
Shady Pines.
Yeah, so it was totally like that joke. It was like, Shady Pines.
Yeah, that's true.
About sending her to to Connecticut.
Is it more of a Jane Austen movie or a Whit Stillman movie, or is the line between the two so unclear that you can't tell?
It's both. It's really both. It's
like both, yeah.
Yeah.
So the novella was never finished, which is why it's a novella. And it was written pretty early, so it's still when she was a little bit, like, punchier and, like, slightly slap-happy in a way that other things weren't. And the novella is all letters. So everything that has turned this movie into actual encounters between people sort of dramatized in real time, that's all Whit Stillman. It's, I think, the funniest Jane Austen movie, and there have been some really funny ones. But yeah. If you put Clueless aside, like, I did laugh quite a lot, especially through, like, the first hour. It's really funny in a way that honors both of them.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
And it points out, makes you realize things in Austen and in Stillman that where they connect, and you're just like, oh yeah, there really has always been this kind of classically, you know, social, like, obviously, like, the social strictures in Stillman stuff, mm-hmm. kind of acerbic wit in Austen stuff. And it's just, it's one of those things where you wouldn't have thought it to be a perfect match until you see it, and it's just like, oh yeah.
And I saw a screening here that he attended, and he was saying how anybody who met him between, like, 18 and 28 knew that he was this dickhead, because he would make a point at parties of being like, I read a Jane Austen novel, I didn't think it was shit. And, like, then later was working at a publishing house and, like, finally read other Victorian, well, later Victorian novels and some Gothic novels and the kinds of things she used to spoof, and then realized what a genius she was.
Yeah.
But it's such a Whit Stillman character thing to do, to be like, Jane Austen sucks, fuck her.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
So it's kind of funny that it took him a while to see the symmetry you're talking about, but I agree with you.
I would just like to hear what everybody's favorite part was, because the thing that killed me, and it kept giving me bliss, was the character card intros of people.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That was just, it was so, like, I don't know if it's original, but it was so fresh to me.
Genius.
Yeah. It was like almost like chapter headings, only just visually, and just made you laugh just from an image, you know?
Yeah. And it's especially funny because they pack all this information into it and they don't hold it up on screen very long. So you do actually have the character's experience of, like, knowing a bunch of stuff about each other but not actually being able to remember what you're supposed to know about them and having to kind of refigure it out.
Yeah, because you get so much right at the beginning and then you have to, like, just, like, reflect back on that. And, yeah, I liked every time Lady Susan, Kate Beckinsale's character, was talking about her daughter. And just sort of, like, off, like, casually offhanded way, she, like, completely tears her down. It's delicious. It's really, really great.
So I was going to have trouble picking among three, and you guys took two of them, which is perfect. So my was that, like, cheerful idiot, that Tom Bennett character.
Yes!
Tom Bennett was amazing.
A moron, but he's so happy about it. Like, I've never seen anybody that sunny about his stupidity. Like, yeah, and, like, the line readings were just so clever, and, yeah, he was incredible.
I thought the whole supporting cast was really funny. I loved the parents.
Where they're reading the letter?
Yeah, that scene was amazing. Yeah.
Did either of you guys tire out from it by the end, or was that just me?
I feel like there was a sense of, we know where this has been headed. Mm-hmm. And there's always that sense of, like, repetition sometimes, just sort of, like, this is maybe, like, one or two scenes too long, but yeah, I could see that.
I didn't really feel that way, and you know I'm very allergic to movies overstaying their welcome. I mean, it didn't feel short to me, which is maybe what you guys are talking about, because it is only 92 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay.
So it didn't feel as short as it actually is to me, so maybe that's, you know, maybe that.
Okay.
It felt full.
I was satiated by the meal.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, maybe because it is one of those plots, too. The part of its comedy is that, like, nobody ever changes colors. We are all who we are.
That is absolutely true. Yeah.
So the point of the humor is that nobody is going to grow or do anything differently. But
yeah, like, what, like,
combinations. But
yeah, Beckinsale's arc is really just like, nope, this all turned out exactly how I expected it would, because I know people. And I like that. There's that sort of, you get that a lot in Stillman, of just sort of like, I know people, I know how things work. And like Beckinsale's character does that in Last Days of Disco really well, where she's sort of like, she's got everybody's number except when she completely doesn't, which I really like. I think you got that in Damsels in Distress a lot too. The movie really made me want to go back and watch all of his other movies, because there's that, it's what I get out of a lot of Aaron Sorkin, and is this kind of, you know, musicality to the dialogue, and it's you know, those familiar beats really are quite comforting.
We haven't heard much from Katie.
I haven't seen it.
You haven't.
Happily,
okay.
Yeah, I'm happily listening to this conversation, but yeah, I have not gotten to it yet. So I'm very curious, and I love hearing these things to look forward to.
And you're gonna have so much time to watch movies coming.
Well, I'm excited that everything that's on demand. Like, I've been kind of mentally compiling a list of like what to, you know, spend my precious 2 hours on, because if I don't have to leave the house, like there's so much available for me to see. So, but I feel like this will be on demand, if not now, relatively soon.
With a newborn, your screeners this season are going to be a godsend.
I know. I thought about trying to start begging for screeners now, just to be like, what do you got? Maybe I'll watch your random documentary I wouldn't have seen otherwise. And I'm hoping to do that and not, like, you know, binge watch SVU or something. Like, I really want to use this time well, but we'll see how well my brain works.
God, binge watching SVU in that state would be quite something.
I know, it would really do something to your brain.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of social experiment that would be.
And your kid will learn a lot.
Yeah, it's a great way to bring a child into the world. I feel like I should teach him Jane Austen and Whit Stillman first.
Maybe.
Early language acquisition. So is Neighbors 2 the only thing we've all seen?
As it should be.
It is, and it's the one we're running out of time for.
I love Neighbors 2.
I did too. I thought it was so great. I thought it was so, like, the difficulty in following up a comedy that you liked so much more than you thought you were going to, and then it's just like, oh god, they're trying again, and like the failure of 22 Jump Street was so kind of
fresh
common in my mind. I was just like, oh no. But man, they really do pull it off. They pull off that thing of, oh, it's just exactly the same plot.
Yeah.
With, like, one little, like, added element. And, like, that usually goes so poorly. It always feels like such a retread. But they managed to, like, inject a lot of fresh ideas into it, which I really loved.
Yeah, these movies are so thoughtful about their characters and invested in, like, having real emotion in there and, like, pausing to stop for people's feelings, that it gets away with all of the nonsense. And, like, all the nonsense is very funny, so it's not like it has to apologize for it. And then, like, makes you feel emotional at the end of the movie watching, like, Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne's character, like, about to go to bed with their 2-year-old. Like, it's really impressive how they manage to balance all of that. And, like, you know, turn Zac Efron into this, like, golden god tragedy figure.
I know.
Lumbering around his old frat house. Like, I've loved Zac Efron for so long, and have, like, always wanted more from him. And it feels like Nicholas Stoller, who directs the Neighbors movies, like, feels the exact same way I do. And it's like, here we go, Zac Efron. Let's give you something where it really works, and no one else is capable of doing it.
Yeah, it totally plays to his persona and his strengths as an actor, which it turns out he has.
Yeah.
And, like, knows his groove, for sure.
Yeah, the moments where he asks, I think it's his repeated line, where he says, would that be of value to you? And he seems so, like, desperate for inclusion. It's so sad. It's so funny.
Yeah.
What'd you guys think?
And also, I don't know if he's the best pratfaller in the movie, or just if I like his pratfalls the best. Like, there's no reason why falling off that zip line should have been the kind of thing I did find hilarious, but I did. I don't know that that's an acting feat, but, you know, he got me.
I do love to watch that man fall down. Yeah.
Exactly. Would you guys
think of, did you like it a little bit less?
I liked it less than the original.
Okay.
But it was very easy sit, and it was funny. Like, I didn't dislike it at all. It didn't feel as, like, amazing as the first one. And that was partially because Rose Byrne is so sidelined. And she was my favorite part of the first one.
I don't know if she's that sidelined, though. I mean, I think she's... I mean, Katie, go ahead with what you were going to say.
Well, no, I was basically going to say the same thing. Like, I feel like she does get her share of pretty great moments, although maybe I'm forgetting like some standout scenes she had in the first one that the second one doesn't compare.
I think with the addition of the newer characters, I think everybody has a little less to do. Mm-hmm. But I like that she's still, even in her capacity as, you know, she's pregnant, she can't quite, like, get involved in the kind of the partying schemes to the degree that she did last time. But, like, there's a scene right at the end where they're, like, everybody's coming to realizations and lessons are being learned and everybody's feeling really good about things. And she just, like, leans out the window, like, halfway out the window and just starts, like, hollering at these girls. And I'm just like, that's so perfectly, like, 0 to 60, so funny. The scene where she runs into the office looking for Seth Rogen, mm-hmm. when she thinks he's left her, and she's just, like, just absolutely screaming at Ike Barinholtz's character and scaring the shit out of him, I thought was really funny. And then the escrow scene at the beginning.
Oh, my God.
The escrow scene was great.
Utterly brilliant. Yeah. And, like, and again, it was just sort of, like, the benefits of not pigeonholing your female lead into a character who, like, knows any more than anybody else. You know what I mean? That sort of, you know, competence in that context would have been really boring. And she just got to be right there with it. And the same with the Lisa Kudrow scene.
I just want to give personal credit to pregnant people doing things other than just having emergency babies in elevators. Like, just living a life. You're pregnant for a long time, man. You got time to do a lot of stuff. And I really appreciated seeing her, like, you know, dressed up in a cheerleader outfit for their weird heist and, like, all kinds of stuff.
I
agree with a lot of those moments, but I also felt a little bit of the sidelining Nathaniel's talking about, but more in the sense that I felt like Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, when together, were often asked to kind of improv in really loose ways. Like, we would cut away to them, you know, like, try to have sex, but don't quite, but sort of make it funny, you know, yeah. Or or like the beginning scene or like, the movie is kind of successful, I thought, in the ways you said about basically having the same plot, but trying to reinvent it. But, like, Zac Efron really gets to go through, like, a whole new thing.
And, yeah.
And many times with Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, I felt like there was just a kind of, you guys were so funny last time, like, do that again.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to complain, because it is quite funny, but, like, I also didn't buy the whole Dave Franco being gay the whole time.
No.
I didn't buy that at all.
Yeah, I was talking to someone about this last night who was, like, asking if the whole, like, gay marriage thing was as well executed as I said, as people said. I said yes, but obviously I'm curious about what you guys think.
I just think there's nothing within the first movie to, not even from his performance, to suggest that he was a closeted homosexual. Whereas there are certain performances where the actor can, you know, put latent things about the character into them. But I think that's a stretch to just reinvent the character in that way.
I think I just felt a certain X-Men problem that it's like, he doesn't have to be in it. Like, and we certainly could have dropped the two best friends of Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen, who have been, in my mind, total albatrosses on both movies. Like, I think they're just awful.
I liked him better in this one, I think, than I liked him in the first one.
Oh, okay. Well, that was a real difference in our experiences. I'll say that.
I will, Nick, I'm on your side with this one.
and that there's so much for, like, the four, because the movie does have ambitions for all four of its protagonists, but it does sometimes feel kind of crowded, and in a way that I especially felt in the sorority girls arc. Like, they just went through these huge, you know, we're best friends now we're fighting, now we're breaking up because you're, like, a frat girl now.
They seemed a little bipolar, those girls.
Yeah.
They were, like, ping-ponging all over the place.
So does that...
Well, by Katie's core constituency of, like, pregnant women, I will just say my personal beef that, like, you could see this movie and not even imagine that college involves college at all. Like, thank you for that, yet again, and giving me more people to work with who resent my part, whatever, anyway. But, I thought, like, everybody would have benefited from having a little more time that would have accrued to them by getting rid of some kind of gratuitous stuff. And if you're not going to really use Lisa Kudrow, which they twice haven't done, like, maybe don't dangle the prospect in front of me, because it just makes me sad.
So, having that thought about the the sorority girls then? Do you feel like the movie has been giving a little bit too much credit for being sort of politically progressive? Because I feel like I've seen some bristling at that. Like, if I've seen any kind of backlash against Neighbors 2, and I really haven't, but it's been along the lines of it's getting too much credit for being, like, for lack of a better term, woke about, like, girls in society, in college, in the way that it tries to be sort of socially aware.
I think that says more about the rest of the movie landscape than this movie.
I think that's probably true, yeah.
Because it's just so barren otherwise in terms of that this, it does feel really progressive while you're watching it because you just don't see that in movies.
And I don't think it's getting too much credit for the effort. Like, I did think that I admired that the movie even wanted to, like, delve into some of those campus politics and the way they get gendered and things like that. Like, the fact that it kind of comes down between, like, two different styles of partying and which one is empowering, I found kind of ridiculous. But
yeah,
although
it was so fascinated with the fact that sororities couldn't throw their own parties to the point where they were like, yeah, I get it. I know this is a real world issue. I'm amazed as you are. Like, okay.
I did love the joke about the ho parties, though.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to credit the movie for, like, I don't remember really anything about the way that women were depicted at the parties in the first movie, which I guess means it, like, wasn't egregious, but to have looked back at its first movies and been like, yeah, all those dumb parties that you laughed at, like, those all are happening in the real world and suck for women, and, like, kind of being a little self-reflexive about it, and then having the Zac Efron character be like, wait, we can't call you hoes? And, like, he's, like, earnest being like, that's not cool anymore, guys, you can't call them hoes. Like, it's just, it's funny, and it's, I don't know, like, the generosity of spirit of it, I keep coming back to, like, that it really wants to, like, it really wants to see from all these different points of view, and even though I think the sorority girls do get a little shafted, and Chloe Moretz is never my favorite, right. That it, like, it goes really out of its way to see things from their point of view, and, like, show them, like, smoking weed in their dorm room, which is, like, so much more, like, what my college experience was like than any of these parties, just, like, sitting on the floor and, like, yeah. Talking to your RA, And
also,
that
texting scene where they turn on Zac Efron is utterly brilliant and terrifying. It's amazing.
Totally true.
Yeah. Nick, is that what your students do to you, too? They banish you?
They so far haven't told me, but I couldn't doubt that it happened.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week.
This was fun, you guys.
It was.
Yeah.
Back together.
Katie, we've missed you so much.
I know. I keep seeing the podcast show up, and I was like, oh, God, I got to get back in before I disappear off the face of the earth for a little while. And I really stop seeing movies. You guys are going to have to start explaining movie plots to me a lot.
That'll be the new format for the podcast. Katie just asks
I've
us questions.
I've heard about this Suicide Squad. What is it?
The mansplain experience.
Oh, my God. Which two oceans is the light between in this movie?